Rediscover God's Word, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is Real Bible Study with teacher Tom Bradford. Welcome to Torah Class.
I think the best way to frame what Zechariah chapter 3 is all about is first to provide the context of how Yehovah saw Judah at the time he exiled them, and the resulting condition of the returned exiles in general. That is, the people that journeyed back to what was now the Persian province of Yehud came home to in anything but a healed spirit or a renewed heart. They lived in a pagan place for 70 years and, of course, had been infected with a heathen cultural perspective, even if it was subconsciously. So much rehabilitation and a rebuilding of trust in their sacred institutions had to be accomplished. The book of Ezekiel gives us a very good synopsis of this condition that we'll use as a prelude to what Zechariah has to say. So if you want to follow along with me, open up to Ezekiel chapter 22. The word of Adonai came to me. Human being, tell her this. You are a land that is neither cleansed nor rained on in the day of fury. There is a conspiracy of prophets in it, like a roaring lion tearing up the prey. They have devoured people, seized wealth and valuables, and widowed many in it. Her Kohanim, that's her priests, have done violence to my Torah, profaned my holy things, made no difference between the holy and the common, not distinguished between unclean and clean, hidden their eyes from my Shabbats, and profaned me among themselves. Her leaders in it are like wolves tearing up the prey to shed blood and destroy people in order to benefit unjustly. Her prophets have plastered for them with whitewash, seeing false visions and divining lies for them, saying, thus says Adonai Elohim, when Adonai has not spoken. The people of the land have extorted, robbed, wronged the poor and needy and unjustly oppressed foreigners. I sought for a man among them who could build a barricade or stand in the break to oppose me on behalf of the land so that I would not destroy it, but I found no one. Therefore, I am pouring out my fury on them, consuming them with the fire of my rage, bringing their own ways on their own heads, says Adonai Elohim. God promised to bring Judah back after 70 years of his anger against them. But that didn't mean that the Judeans had undergone a major spiritual transformation up in Babylon. The place he decided to begin this transformation was with the temple and its priesthood, which is one of the reasons he was demanding that the temple be reconstructed and put back into service urgently. Now, the people felt abandoned by the priesthood, even before they had left for Babylon. And in exile, apparently the priesthood did little good for those who had been forcefully moved out of their homeland by the invaders. What was needed then was a restoration of the people's trust and their confidence in the fidelity and authority of the priesthood. And as we just read in Ezekiel, the priesthood had been equally as sullied and corrupted as every other Judean institution, and they needed an opportunity to show that they had learned their lesson. So turn your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 3. Zechariah chapter 3. Starting at verse 1. He showed me Yahshua, the Kohen Hagadol, that's Joshua the high priest, standing before the angel of Adonai with the accuser, standing at his right to accuse him. Adonai said to the accuser, "May Adonai rebuke you, accuser. Indeed, may Adonai, who has made Jerusalem his choice, rebuke you. Isn't this man a burning stick snatched from the fire?" Yahshua was clothed in garments covered with dung. He was standing before the angel, who said to those standing in front of him, "Take those filthy garments off of him." And then to him he said, "See, I'm taking your guilt away. I will clothe you in fine robes." And I said, "Well, they should put a clean turban on his head." So they put a clean turban on his head and gave him fine robes to wear while the angel of Adonai stood by. Then the angel of Adonai gave Joshua this warning. Adonai Zevaot says this, "If you will walk in my ways, obey my commission, judge my house, and guard my courtyards, then I will give you free access among these who are standing here. Listen, Kohen Hagadol, Joshua. Both you and your colleagues seated here before you, because these men are a sign that I am going to bring my servant Tzemach. For look at the stone I have put in front of Joshua. On one stone are seven eyes. I will engrave what is to be written on it." So that an eye save a oat. "And I will remove the guilt of this land in one day. When that time comes," says Adonai Zevaot, "you will all invite each other to join you under your vines and fig trees." Well, this is the fourth vision in a series of visions given to Zechariah. And the first words of the first verse present us with a conundrum. Who is the he who showed me? And the answer is, your guess is as good as mine. I don't think it's the interpreting angel, because that angel tends to explain what is shown, not the one who presents the vision. Might it be then the angel of Yahweh? Could be. And it is my choice is the most likely candidate. Most Bible scholars say it is Yahweh himself that is the he. And I'm suspicious of that, because it moves far away from all that we have seen so far in the book of Zechariah. But what speaks against my view is that almost immediately the angel of Yahweh is added to the vision as a participating character. So now a new character comes onto the scene, the accuser. We might even list the character of Joshua as a second new character, except that this isn't actually about the person of Joshua so much as it is about the office he holds, the high priest. And even more that he is representative of the character of the high priest office and probably the character of the priesthood in general. On the other hand, we don't want to degrade this into purest symbolism, because Joshua was indeed a real person who was the high priest at this time. There are no imaginary symbolic objects or people involved in this vision. Now, the way the Hebrew grammar and syntax works together is to connect this new vision with the previous one. And at the same time, this fourth vision stands as somewhat unique compared to visions 1 through 3 and 5 through 7. For instance, it doesn't begin with the more standard opening protocols used by prophets to announce visions and oracles. This is the middle vision. It is the fulcrum that operates at the center of the seven visions. And without doubt, this is why it is somewhat different in its nature compared to the other six. Now, if this seems a little odd or confusing, keep in mind the most unique and challenging nature of the entire book of Zechariah, as we discussed at the introduction. Now, what we are witnessing in this fourth vision is something that is happening in the heavenly court. And it is essentially an investiture ceremony for the high priest, who, again, is representative of both his own office as well as the institution of the priesthood in general. And at a yet higher level, God's reinvestment of Joshua in the priesthood as his chosen institution to lead Israel in spirituality and morality is also indicative of his assurance that Israel remains his chosen vessel on earth to bring the knowledge and truth of Yahweh to the world. Well, when it comes to attempting to understand the role of Joshua in this vision, I think we can do no better than to hear the words of the eminent Bible scholar of the early 19th century, Theodore Kleefoot. And he says this concerning Joshua's presence on the heavenly court. It says, the character of Israel as the holy and priestly nation of God was violated. Violated with the general sin and guilt of the nation, which God had been obliged to punish with exile. This guilt of the nation, which neutralized the priestliness and holiness of Israel, is pleaded by Satan in the accusation which he brings forth before Malach of Jehovah against the high priest, who was its representative. A nation so guilty and so punished could no longer be the holy and priestly nation. Its priests could no longer be priests, nor could its high priests be high priests anymore. But the Malach of Jehovah sweeps away the accusation with the assurance that Jehovah, from his grace and for the sake of election, will still give validity to Israel's priesthood and has already practically manifested this purpose of his by bringing it out of its penal condition of exile. Now, in contrast to this, we find a wholly different mindset of the preeminent European Bible scholars of the later 19th century, Kiel and Delitzsch, that well expresses the consensus view of traditional Christianity at that time, and as it still exists and holds sway over most of the modern church in the 21st century. Now, I realize that it might seem that too often I pile on to the traditional institution of the Gentile church at every opportunity, and for this, I am likely guilty. I have no desire to demonize because the church has done so much good. Yet, there are some things that are so off track in their fundamental doctrines that they must not go unchallenged. So I want to present you with a quote from those respected Bible scholars that is really the antithesis of what Kleefoot had to say. So to open their study about this fourth vision of Zechariah, they say this: in this and the following visions, the prophet is shown the future glorification of the church of the Lord. How amazingly different that is from Kleefoot's. And how grateful I am for those Christian scholars like him that can accept and write about the truth as it's found in Holy Writ and not attempt to twist it into something not recognizable. I mean, I cringe every time I read statements like this by highly acclaimed Christian Bible scholars. One has to ask how in the world one can read prophecies that are specifically and emphatically only about Judah and Israel and somehow conclude that this is actually code for a brand new Gentiles-only faith created in the fourth century. The answer is that perhaps the underlying foundational principle of the Constantinian church is that Gentile Christians and the church have replaced the Hebrew people in Israel. Now, even though the church acknowledges the Jewish Savior, and rightfully and successfully has brought this basic knowledge of Christ to the world, according to Christianity, everything God promises to our Savior's people, Israel, has been canceled, taken away, redirected to the Gentile church. Therefore, Israel is to expect nothing but God's anger, wrath, and curses because they are the Christ killers. To that terribly bigoted and wrong doctrine, I say this. If those who truly love Yeshua and want to know who the real historical Yeshua was and is, and want to know the truth about why he came and what he taught, then it necessarily involves reading the Bible and taking it for what it says. Facing up to this 1,600-year-old false doctrine and others like it that forms so many of the founding and ongoing principles of Christianity. Such thoughts are so thoroughly embedded in church history and philosophy and theology that nothing but a direct frontal assault against it is going to eradicate it. Or probably more realistically, get at least some believers to sit up and take notice, and then for those believers to take action. All right, enough said. Getting back to the scene Zechariah is being presented. Joshua has been brought into a heavenly courtroom of sorts in order to be prosecuted by a new character called the Accuser. Clearly, it is the Father sitting on his throne who is the great judge. And the words standing before lend weight to the scene as a defendant standing before the trial judge. And just as I regularly bring up certain challenges to confront the teachings of our traditional Christian institutions because they often do not reflect biblical truth, so I have recently begun to bring up this issue of the existent reality of Yahweh's divine counsel and of his heavenly court. Several sayings of the Psalms, of Job, of the prophets are not really understandable until we recognize that what they are mentally envisioning are the many administrative and judicial functions going on in heaven, and even to a degree, who it is that mans the associated offices and positions. Now, I've explained that it is particular divinely created beings called the Elohim that sit on God's divine council. And now we get a view of God's heavenly court system. And for this, Yahweh sits as the sole judge. No one else is permitted to rule when the issue is judicial in nature, as it is in Zechariah's fourth vision. Now the accuser, the prosecutor, if you would, bringing a judicial complaint before God is in Hebrew called Ha-Satan. The angel of Yahweh, in this scene we could call him the advocate for the defendant, then stands in opposition to the accuser. Now, interestingly, we don't hear the accuser speak. Nor do we get a narrative from him about what his accusation amounts to. It is only implied by what God's response to it is. Now, the Hebrew term ha-satan is where the Christian world gets its term Satan from. And like many terms, this one is morphed in meaning over the centuries. If we were to literally translate Hebrew, it would say the Satan, which in the way Christianity thinks of it is odd. That is, in this era, the term Satan was not used as a formal name the way Christians do. So we have to search to determine what the term Satan best translates to in English. And here, since very clearly he is depicted as the prosecutor in a trial, then the term, or rather title of the accuser is probably the best choice. So is ha-satan necessarily doing evil? Or is he merely a prosecutor doing his job? A good parallel to what we find here in Zechariah is Psalm 109. And in verse 6 we read, they say, appoint a wicked man over him, may an accuser stand at his right. So in this psalm, we find a judicial setting, and the term a wicked man is made synonymous with accuser, which, by the way, in this psalm also uses the Hebrew Satan. However, it is only later Christianity that takes this term and turns it into a formal name for the devil. In the King James Version of the same verse, we read in Psalm 109:6, see thou a wicked man over him, and let Satan stand at his right hand. Now, whether or not we ought to call this accusing figure Satan, or just leave it at the accuser, notwithstanding, this is some kind of a spiritual being that opposes God in a number of ways, and therefore opposes those whom God uses, elects, or anoints. For us to get a better sense of this accusing figure, let's turn to the book of Job. In Job 1, starting at verse 6, we read this. It happened one day that the sons of God came to serve Yahweh, and among them came the adversary. And Yahweh asked the adversary, where are you coming from? And the adversary answered Yahweh, from roaming through the earth, wandering here and there. And Yahweh asked the adversary, did you notice my servant Job? There's no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil. And the adversary answered Yahweh, is it for nothing that Job fears God? You put a protective hedge around him, his house, everything he has. You've prospered his work, and his livestock are spread out all over the land. But if you reach out your hand and touch whatever he has without doubt, he'll curse you to your face. And Yahweh said to the adversary, here, everything he has is in your hands, except you're not to lay a finger on his person. Then the adversary went out from the presence of Yahweh. Now, everywhere we see the word adversary in this Job excerpt, the Hebrew is ha-satan, just as we find it in Zechariah chapter 3. And in this Job story, it might not be entirely out of place to use the term the accuser instead of the adversary. Now, apparently, this divine being has been assigned the job of wandering around on earth and then bringing back reports on what he sees to Yahweh. On the other hand, this is less a judicial setting and more simply a regular meeting of God's divine counsel. We can know this because of how the story begins with the words, "It happened one day that the sons of God came to serve Yahweh." In Hebrew, the sons of God is Ben Elohim. And while I can't spend the time today to fully flesh this out, you can go to previous lessons and others of the books of the minor prophets that I've taught where I've explained it more thoroughly. The bottom line is that Ben Elohim is a term that speaks of a special class of divine beings who are the administrators of heaven. These are the creatures that form God's divine council. And God, Yahweh, delegates duties and tasks to them, and they carry them out. Here we learn that HaSatan is one of those creatures. Yet just as those several Elohim are not given names, neither is HaSatan. Rather, HaSatan is a description of his purpose or function. And that purpose is to wander the earth and bring back reports of things he finds suspicious or wrong and present those things to Yahweh to decide on what to do about them. Now, the nature of HaSatan always seems to be to present to Yahweh the suspected dark side to those whom God declares as righteous or at least as elect. Thus, it is not that HaSatan is necessarily always doing an evil thing in the way we might think about it, but rather that he likes being a tattletale on those whom God especially favors. In fact, in Job, just as in Zechariah, God doesn't tell the accuser that he's wrong or he's wicked for bringing these charges. Only that God is not going to rule against these people and instead is going to respond by showing them special grace. Therefore, it is likely that the Ben Elohim, who is given the task of roaming the earth to report back to God what he sees, is not lying about it. So the reason we are even given these glimpses into the workings of the divine council seems to be to see how heaven functions, to learn about some of the divine beings involved, to understand that God does know what goes on down here, and that there is a specific authorized Ben Elohim who seems to enjoy bringing bad news to God about those on earth that God favors. No doubt, whom God favors is no secret among the members of the divine council. Now, what I've just explained to you is more or less how the Israelites and Judeans of Zerubbabel's era understood how things operated in the spiritual realm. This was their mental image of it all. And therefore, this is why we find these scriptures written as they were. It sounds pretty strange to us, be that as it may, until we can grasp how it is they saw it, then we cannot grasp what this is meant to convey. Of course, HaSatan went on to represent a demonic figure, especially after he was cast down out of heaven. But still, in Zechariah 3, we're left to wonder what exactly precipitated the accuser bringing this charge against Joshua to Yahweh. And my take is that I think it is self-evident what the cause was, and that is why I presented an excerpt from Ezekiel 22 to open today's study. The priesthood had become a clearly sullied institution. Yahweh obviously knew it, And the accuser was questioning why God would want to have the high priest and the priesthood reinstituted, and why he would still find favor in the badly corrupted Israel. God responds to the accuser, starting in verse 2. Yahweh said to the accuser, "May Yahweh rebuke you, accuser. Indeed, may Yahweh, who has made Jerusalem his choice, rebuke you. Isn't this man a burning stick snatched from the fire?" See, Yahweh puts the accuser in his place. He says, "Rebuke you." God finds the charges irrelevant. So he's rejecting the prosecuting attorney's reasoning for bringing these charges. And further, we see Yahweh respond to part of Hasatan's accusation that was not recorded for us, but now it's implied. It is that in addition to bringing a case against Joshua, the representative of the high priest office, it is also against Jerusalem as God's favored city. Why would Hasatan think that God might agree with him that Jerusalem should no longer be God's chosen city? Because once before, God's choice of a favored city was revoked. Shiloh. That revocation was permanent. So it's not that Joshua was somehow perfectly suited or not to be high priest, nor that Jerusalem was perfectly suited or not to be God's holy city. It is that this is purely God's prerogative to make these choices. He has decided, and that's that. Remembering what we discussed earlier, that Joshua is representative both of the entire priesthood and at a higher level also as all Israel, then we get another proof that God has not and never will permanently reject Israel, Jerusalem, or the Hebrew people. And he certainly is not going to replace that which he has not rejected. Now, verse 2 concludes with these words that are the more literal translation of the Hebrew. "Is this not a brand plucked from the fire?" Now, I want to present it this way because hidden just beneath the surface is a play on words. We get this nearly exact statement from the book of Amos. In Amos 4:11, "I overthrew some of you as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. You were like a burning stick snatched from the fire. Still, you haven't returned to me," says Yahweh. A brand is a stick, or even better, a thorny weed or a vine. That is, it is something useless or troublesome. But the key word is fire. In Amos, the Hebrew word used for fire is seraphah. The statement then is something of a proverb, maybe an expression that was in use at that time. It has special significance for Joshua because his grandfather, Sariah, which is taken from the word seraphah, was the high priest who was executed when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Judah. So whereas some Judeans, and obviously Hasatan, may have looked at what could only be viewed by most of them as a failed and corrupted high priesthood that ought to be done away with permanently, burned up like a brand, God rescued it and used this statement he had made some years earlier to Amos to make his point. The point is that whatever consequence may have been well deserved, God will, at his own determination, instead offer rescue and mercy. Now, it's when we see this statement in this light that we get further validation of one of Jehovah's most wonderful attributes. He will forgive what seems like the unforgivable, if he so chooses. This is a choice. It's a decision that only he as God has the right to make. And it's on a case-by-case basis. In the law of Moses, Yahweh hands down many laws and their accompanying punishments for breaking them. For many of these infractions, God offers no provision for human judges to forgive or to lessen the punishment he's ordained. For instance, the law makes it clear that unjustifiable killing of a person must bring with the death penalty. No other resolution is possible. But God, in his mercy, has the option for his own good reasons to offer such special mercy as and when he sees fit. Now, depending on one's viewpoint, this is an attribute of God that you may like or not like. That is, seeing it as serendipitous, unfair, perhaps expressing partiality, or even as hypocritical. I caution, don't let your mind go there. Our sitting in judgment over God is never a good idea. What is a good idea is to read the Holy Scriptures to better understand God, accepting him as he is, and not attempting to either create a doctrine to change it or to think we are in a position to anoint ourselves with the same choices he reserves only for himself. If he won't even allow his highest spiritual creatures, the Bein Elohim, to make judicial decisions in the heavenly court, then it follows that we mere humans certainly have no such right. So verse 3 explains that Joshua was standing in filthy garments before God and the accuser. Now the Hebrew word used here to describe his garments is tzoh. And it is much more than meaning dirty or soiled. It represents the foulest of the foul. It is a word used to describe what I will, as delicately as possible, compared to used toilet paper. That is, it can't get any worse than this. So the condition in which those who are part of the heavenly court are viewing Joshua as high priest and as all Israel is the lowest of the low. And it is painfully obvious to all who are present. No wonder Hasatan thought he was bringing a pretty solid case before God. Now, when we're told that Joshua was standing next to or before the angel, this seems to mean the angel of Yahweh. At least I can't find a better candidate to explain him. And we find Joshua more or less described as standing in that position back in verse 1. Beginning in verse 4, the angel of Yahweh speaks out to everyone present and orders, rather surprisingly, I think, to take those filthy garments off Joshua. Whom exactly is tasked with doing that is not specified. But what we are witnessing is a divine act of cleansing. Joshua is helpless to do this for himself. His impurity was so great that no ritual he could perform, no task he could commit to, no apology or repentance he could offer would ever solve the problem. Only the sovereignty of the Father had the authority to do it. That it is the angel of Yahweh that issues the order makes clear his authority to speak for Yahweh. And yet, it is equally as clear that the person of Yahweh is right there. So why didn't he order it? Now, while I don't have any answer to this, it does bring up the issue of these various manifestations of God that we encounter throughout the Bible that do have a unity, but at the same time, they have a quality of separateness. Here in this scene, we find the Father and the angel of Yahweh appearing together, but as separate entities for separate purposes in the proceedings of the heavenly court. The Father is the judge. The angel is the defender. What this removal of the filthy garment means is explicitly stated in Zechariah 3:4. Then to him he said, "See, I'm taking your guilt away. I'll clothe you in fine robes." Now, more literally, it says, "I have taken away your iniquity and will clothe you in festal robes." Joshua is being purified, and whatever impurity and guilt there was is now gone. Forgiveness, restoration, and acceptance have happened. It's immediate. The mention of festal clothing means a reinstatement of all of Joshua's high priestly roles and lofty position. This scenario is also envisioned in Isaiah, and it's something we all need to be thankful for. Listen to Isaiah 61:10. "I am so joyful in Yahweh. My soul rejoices in my God, for he has clothed me in salvation, dressed me with a robe of triumph, like a bridegroom wearing a festive turban, like a bride adorned with her jewels." And as a reminder, because the role Joshua plays in this scene is as representative, less of himself and more of the priesthood in Israel in general, then we can easily agree with Cleaforth that this is clearly a picture of all Israel still having validity in God's eyes for their existence and purpose as God had originally ordained for them. Israel has been reinstated as a holy and priestly nation. In other words, it completes the reversal of their guilt and exile. Now, I mentioned earlier that this fourth vision, this fulcrum that stands at the center of the seven visions is rather unique as compared to the other six. So here in verse 5, we see Zechariah suddenly being interjected into the vision as a character operating within it, as opposed to what he has been up to now, a reporting observer. It is Zechariah that says to no one in particular, they should put a clean turban on his head. And in response, the unnamed they who are present do put a clean turban as well as clean garments on Joshua. Now, in reality, the word to describe the turban and the fresh garment is not clean, but rather it is pure. The Hebrew word is tahor, and it is used in a ritual sense. So while it is indeed the opposite of unclean, when it comes to the priests, then ritual purity is the issue, and it's not about something that is merely dirty and has now been washed. The turban, the mitre, this is a headpiece worn by the high priest. A special metal plate is attached to this kind of turban that says, "Holy to Yahweh," and only the high priest may wear it. Now, while this investment, or maybe better, reinvestment ceremony might usually conclude with the high priest donning his turban, instead, the scene continues on with what we read in verses 6 and 7. There we read, "Then the angel of Yahweh gave Joshua this warning. Yahweh Zevaot says this, 'If you will walk in my ways, obey my commission, judge my house and guard my courtyards, then I will give you free access among these who are standing here.'" Now, a warning is given to Joshua, not by the angel of Yahweh, but through the angel. The message itself comes from the mind and the authority of Yahweh, and it's his words. The warning essentially says that this entire reinstatement is prefaced upon obedience. The word if means what has been done for Joshua, and especially now for all Israel, is conditional. And the conditions are spelled out. If you will walk in my ways, obey my commission, judge my house, and guard my courtyards. If Israel, and if the priesthood does that, then the reinstatement will continue. Now, please note that this sounds so familiar to when the law was first given to Moses on Mount Sinai. All covenants of God, despite what you may have heard and believed, are conditional. Both sides have responsibilities. And while it would be a stretch to call this reinstatement scene a covenant renewal ceremony, in effect, it kind of acts like one. Thus, the expectations of God upon Israel have been reconfirmed with some words added that apply mostly to the Levite priesthood. Judging God's house means to rule over the temple. Guarding his courtyards refers to the courtyards that are contiguous with the temple, and it means to protect them from being defiled. Now, to parse these instructions a little further, we need to recall some material from earlier lessons in Zechariah. Up to now in Israelite history, the existence of a Hebrew king as head of the Israelite monarchy that ruled over Israel and Judah was presupposed. The temple with its priesthood were at least partly a visual validation of that king to rule and reign. But conditions at the moment were very different than in the past. Not only was the former Judah now a Persian province called Yehud, but also there was no Hebrew king. Instead, a Persian civil servant was hired to act as governor of Yehud. This was a Jewish man, as that governor didn't change that fact. The high priest Joshua was given an expanded role in governing that province. And while the Persian-appointed Jewish governor dealt with purely civil matters, the high priest now dealt not only with religious matters, but also some civil issues, including the justice system. Therefore, we get these strange instructions from Yehovah to Joshua about judging my house. Now, in prior times, the king had always been the chief judicial authority. God was now confirming Joshua as that judicial authority. So it is almost incorrect to speak of Joshua as high priest because he was now so much more than that. In Judah's current situation, perhaps we should think of Joshua as the chief officer of the temple who was responsible to execute justice in most facets of Jewish life. Now, as head-scratching as this entire verse is, none of it causes such uncertainty as its meaning, then its final words, then I will give you free access among those who are standing here. Those who are standing here. Well, that can only refer to the members of God's heavenly court and those various divine beings who are present in the same. So in what way is Joshua to have access to the heavenly court? Perhaps the point is that Joshua is now the head of the Supreme Court of the earthly realm of Israel in a similar way that the court in heaven is the Supreme Court for justice in heaven. Or maybe it is that since Israelite kings were to have access to heavenly direction through their prophets, now Joshua's high priest will have that same access to heavenly direction. Now, it's my opinion that it is the latter, because of this strange new governance over Israel that they're faced with, and that God seems to be giving his official stamp of approval. That is, whereas God's highest representative on earth had up to now been Israelite kings, now it's Israelite high priests, beginning with Joshua. Okay, we're going to stop here for today, and we'll finish up chapter 3 next time.
For more teachings of real Bible study and to rediscover God's Word with Tom Bradford, visit Torah Class today on the web, streaming TV, or download the Torah Class mobile app.